Born and brought up in Bishop Stainton. Years 1944 to 1962. Born and brought up in Bishop Stainton was in itself a unique experience, I suppose partly because in those days there was nothing else to compare it with. I am Colin William Back, son of William Bill Back, 1913-1985, who was born at 9 Radway Hill at Bishop Stainton, and Gwendolyn, nee Gwen Dennis, 1910-1964, born in King Stainton. My twin brother Paul and I were born in 1944. Sadly, Paul did not survive outside the womb. There were three older brothers, Dennis 1942 to 2021 and John 1945 to 2006. We four were all born at 27 Fore Street. My eldest brother David 1934 to 1977 was born at 7 Fore Street, above Garland's Bakers. Number 7 was then at the top of 4 Street. I am the only son left now. 4 Street originally started by the village hall going towards Huntley. When my parents moved to 27 4 Street, circa 1935, this lower part was known as Post Office Street. My paternal grandmother, Lavinia Mary Back, 1876-1948, lived at 9 Radway Hill and raised 8 children there, while at the same time working as a laundress from home. They had one ground floor living room that had a black leaded stove. The kitchen was part of the passage from the front door to the back. This housed a coal and wood-fired water boiler for the laundry, while upstairs there were two bedrooms and a very cold attic. And there was an outside loo and no bathroom. My grandfather John Back, 1870 to 1918, died aged 47, a victim of the Spanish flu, also known as the 1918 pandemic. 228,000 people died in Britain alone. He had been a gardener for the lovely Tapley Hotel. My maternal grandmother, Florence, known as Flo Valens, 1885 to 1962, together with her second husband, Thomas or Tom Valens, moved from King's Dayton to become the landlords of the Manor Inn at Post Office Street, later to become 4 Street. My maternal grandfather, Frederick George Dennis, 1885 to 1914, which was Florence's first husband, died aged 29. He was one of the Royal Navy crew who sailed the submarine AE-1 from England to Australia, the first submarine in the Australian fleet. The AE-1 went down off Papua New Guinea, all hands lost. Florence was left with three children under the age of 5, Charles, Gwen, my mother, and Catherine, known as Kit. They had been ready to sail to Australia to join my grandfather. At Christmas 2018, 104 years after it disappeared, my cousin Roger, who was the son of Charles, and myself were sent news from Australia, from the AE-1 Descendants Association. The AE-1 had been found. It was incredible news and quite an emotional moment to receive photos of it in its final resting place. Tom and Florence later had a daughter, Cynthia, known as Thora, 1928 to 1986, an adopted daughter, Barbara Dorothy Gertrude, also known as Pat, 1927 to January 2022. Around about 1941, they moved to the Dewdrop Inn at King Stainton. When Florence retired several years after losing Tom, she returned to Bishop Stainton to a bungalow built for her by her son. She chose the very top of Merley Crescent, that part then known as Verlin Estate. She named her bungalow Valden, the the first three letters of her two married names. Both my parents lost their fathers at an early age, Dad at age 4 and Mum at age 3. I was lucky in being raised with family around me. My father had two brothers, a sister and their families living in the village, and a brother and family in Tynmouth. My mother's sister Kit married Jack Ward, who owned the butcher shop and lived next door to us before leaving England to live in America in the 50s. In my story, I've added surnames to those relatives who were close family friends or neighbours. It was frowned on to address married couples, older people or most over 21 from outside the family by first names. It was always Mr, Mrs, Miss, Aunt, Uncle, Grandad, Gran, etc. A professional title example, doctor or nurse, or service title for a major or colonel. Sheila Robbins, niece Skinner, was always known as a Kayla, and Fred Paulette was always known as Scouty. Our teachers, the village police officers, the vicars and other professionals were all treated with greatest respect, not only by the children, but also by the parents. Within the village, even as a small child, one could feel that change was in the air. Menfolk were returning to their families following their war service, some having experienced worse condition than others did. Some children, who were only babies when their fathers were away in the national forces, had to get used to having a man as head of the household. Fathers seemed to have a stricter approach to family life. Some children had only known Mum as being in charge. My younger brother and I went with my mother to Exeter Army Barracks to meet Dad on the day of his discharge from the army. It was exciting yet bewildering. We had only seen Dad when he had been on leave. At this time, most items were still on ration. Essential foods, for example, meat, butter, tea, sugar and margarine, had been on ration since 1940, with clothes and even soap following soon after. The last to come off rationing in 1954 was meat, butter, cheese and fats. How mums managed in those days was incredible. They helped each other. As children, we were not given coffee or tea, but I remember my father enjoying the cup of camp coffee, a chicory essence blend. Some of the mums were quite good at making their own small amount of butter and cream. Being in the country, there were a few who raised some chickens and eggs. Sometimes we had hand-me-down clothes, not just from the family, but up and down the street as well. We were not proud. We were all in the same boat, but at least we had something different to wear. Clothes we grew out of was passed on to whoever needed them. My mother and a few others would go to the jumble sales and buy up knitted articles for a few coppers, take them home, rip them out and wind the wool into skeins, wash them and use the wool to knit new articles. We always had new jumpers for Christmas. Mum seemed to be always knitting, taking orders for the growing children of others, and on occasions my mother would knit in exchange for someone else sewing or helping in other ways. She knitted many new baby outfits free to help new mothers to get started. As a youngster, I hated having to sit with skeins of wool hooked over open hands and stretched out between open arms while my mother wound the wool into balls. With all other articles, it was a case of make, do and mend, whether it was ripped sheets or holes in our socks, which was called darning, lowering or taking up a hem or turning a shirt collar or cuff. There was a need for everything to last a little longer. At the end of their purposeful life, articles became dishcloth, floor cloth, polishing cloth and dusters. Some white linen became boiling cloth in which to cook a steamed pudding. Coloured or patterned material became school gym or plimsoll bags. Buttons cut from old clothes went into a button tin, together with hooks and eyes and reusable zips. Nothing was wasted. We took shoes to Mr. Dodd for repair. He and his wife lived in the first house on Teamview Terrace. His workshop was right at the top of a steep garden. Mrs. Dodd, a kindly lady, would let me through the house to the garden. And as one was leaving back through the house, there was a biscuit waiting, often home-cooked. Some old shoes that had to last the summer out before new ones were bought for going back to school had cardboard put inside to try and stop the wet and grit getting into the shoe through holes in the soles. Our village was made up of four functioning churches and chapels, plus one retired chapel. Seven farms, two butcher shops, four grocery shops, a chemist, three pubs, greengrocers, newsagent, two garages, a post office, a wool shop, a baker, later which became a fresh fish shop, two hotels, a cafe, later became a ladies' hairdresser, two taxi services, three builders and decorator firms, a cobbler, a barber, a village bus service, a chimney sweep, who also doubled as the church graveyard caretaker. A clock and watch repairer, a resident district nurse, a resident village policeman, and a school with a head teacher who lived in the village. The residential became a mixture of many big houses, large houses, and cottages, and an important core of many smaller original village cottages. It was great fun when the chimney sweep came. We watched intently as it added rod after rod to the brush head and eased it up the chimney. At a given signal from Mr. Burgess, we children ran outside to watch for the brush to appear out of the top of the chimney pot. Once it was stuck halfway down, which did not please Mr. Burgess, but with a little bit of manoeuvring, he soon got it loose, followed by a pile of soot. The soot is to be used to feed the gardens. It seemed to be fun when the chimney sweep came until I read the story The Water Babies, from which time, with a kid's imagination of Mr. Burgess sending us up the chimney, I was not so keen on hanging about. The doctor's surgery, usually Dr. Kelly from Tynmouth, took place twice a week, and was held in the front room of Aunt Dessa and Uncle Sam Taylor, two doors down from the Manor Inn. There was also Dr. Rosalind Cooper, who ran a surgery from her house in the main road, now named Newton Road, on home visits. One would always see Dr. Cooper accompanied by her wooden trunk. She collected plant specimens and cuttings from her patients' gardens as she visited. She introduced Dr. Tuck to the village as a partner. They initially worked from her house. Once a week, Dr. Cooper with her housekeeper went country dancing in the village hall. The doctor employed me, 1 6 pence in old money, for 3 hours to sit with, read to and feed her brother-in-law, who was blind. I was about 10 years old when I started. He was obviously well-educated and gently spoken man. He had only recently lost his sight and really appreciated the time when he had someone to read to him, and always praised my ability to read so well. I think it worked two ways. If I had not spent time with him, I would probably have never read some of the classics, and listening to him increased my interest in social history. A bank also visited the village once a week, and transactions took place in the front room of Mr. and Mrs. Harris, two doors up from the central garage. We also had our regular postman who delivered to the whole of Bishop Stainton on foot every day. He and his dog seemed to be there during all my growing up years. Most of the cottages and smaller homes had toilets outside. Some, like ours, it was halfway down the backyard. Several, like my grandmother's home on Radway Hill, shared a toilet with the neighbouring cottage, with a door each side. Most homes had some sort of stand, standalone boiler of gas or coal to heat water for both laundry and baths. No central heating or running hot water. Mum boiled a kettle for us to have an ordinary wash and for Dad's shave. Some used either a communal or outside water pump. Baths were once a week, usually a Friday evening, ready for the weekend. A tin bath brought in from outside and put in front of the fire. We all bathed in turn using the same water, which from time to time Mum would top up with some extra hot water. After our baths, we had a hot milk drink and were put to bed. Once we were settled, it was Dad's turn to have his bath in peace and quiet. We had a bungalow bath, which was galvanised, tapered and about 5 foot long. One had to be careful in the winter as the side nearest the fire would get very hot. The bath usually hung outside, and sometimes in the summer when the weather was hot, my mother would part fill it with cold water for us to play in. In 1962, our old cob-built kitchen was demolished and replaced with a new kitchen, bathroom and toilet, replaced the old building. A small coke-fired boiler was built in the corner of the kitchen, giving hot water for the bathroom and kitchen, plus an airing cupboard. It was heaven, though no central heating.